dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of uncommon intelligence, whom we have a chance to visit with most of the weeks, is Robert Charles, a former Assistant Secretary of State with responsibility for international narcotics and law enforcement, but he served in a variety of other capacities as well, including as a naval officer specializing in intelligence and as an attorney in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush presidencies and the White House, in fact, in the course of which he had occasion to oversee NASA and its budgets and policies. And who better to talk to about something that, particularly as a spokesman for the Association of Mature American Citizens, might be able particularly to help that audience recognize the familiar problem to those of us of a certain age of hostile powers seeking to dominate space. Then it was the Soviet Union for many of us, but now it's China. And Bobby Charles, I'm just so glad to have you with us and appreciate the chance to visit with you about this issue of a booster rocket stage that went hurtling overhead in its descent to Earth, unguided descent to Earth, over cities like New York and Los Angeles recently. Your thoughts on all of this, but first, welcome.
You're absolutely right. The generation which, in many ways, I speak for AMAC, they've got 2.1 million members. And as you know, they are the conservative alternative for those over the age of 50 with all kinds of economic benefits. But they're also looking out for America. And they lived, that group of individuals, again, AMAC.us, and we'll probably have articles out on this topic as well. That group of individuals lived through the period of time in the early 1960s. Actually, it started in late 50s, 1959, when Soviet Union began to put up satellites, the Sputnik satellite. People went out in their backyards and actually looked up. My father, for many years, worked for NASA. And so we were, you know, the four kids in our family were quite focused on it. Later, of course, I did oversight of NASA. What you're pointing out here is really significant. And it is that it's really, there's a micro and a macro. The macro side is that, the micro side, let's start there, is that China put up a March 5B rocket on May 5th. And like many of the things that China does, China did not pay attention to a lot of the protocols. They have violated a lot of the understandings that have to do with the use of space, not just junk in space, but use of space weapons and other material actions in space. And I think we have to be very, very focused on China as we once were on the Soviet Union. What they did in this case is they allowed a large stage of a very large rocket, 20 tons actually was the size of the material, the debris, to not to be properly decommissioned and brought down over the Atlantic or over the Pacific, but rather to just hurtle down to Earth. And it did pass over New York and Los Angeles, according to public reports, both military and civilian. And I think that's very problematic. Obviously, you know, it starts out at about 18,000 miles an hour. By the time it slammed into something in New York or LA, it would have been much slower than that, having been slowed down in the atmosphere. But it would still have been a real shock. And I think it demonstrates on the micro side how irresponsible China is. On the macro side, we have to always be now focused on China. They are doing 10 things from Sunday that do not comport with international norms, and we just have to be focused on that.
Well, let's talk a little bit more. And your father's personal history, as well as your own in space-related matters, is really perfect for this, because what I'm interested in, Bobby, is not simply their irresponsibility. Heavens knows we've seen a lot of that in connection with this pandemic as well. But it's also their ambitions. Can you shed any light on the effort that the Chinese seemingly are making to dominate this so-called Earth-Moon system and what that could mean for our security as well as commercial activities and other things here on Earth?
Yeah, Yeah, I think what people need to recognize is that in many ways, China is more dangerous to us today, both in space and here on Earth, than the Soviet Union was in their day. Doesn't mean that the Soviet Union didn't have a lot of ICBMs. Didn't mean that we didn't get to a couple of real brinks. But China is much more intent with much less anchor and accountability, much more intent, I would say, on dominating different spheres. It's not just the economic sphere, and it's not just the South China Sea. It's also space. And that you have near-Earth orbit where they can do damage to our satellite systems, both communications, military, environmental, all kinds of factors up there. But they also, of course, have put a probe on the far side of the moon. They have moon ambitions. So, you know, when you have a communist country that can divert all kinds of resources away from the people and over to basically an adventurous or expansionist ideology, you've taken the genie out of the bottle. And that's really the problem we've got. China, as a communist country, can divert a lot of capital and a lot of labor to things like dominating space.
I did want to just touch on one point, because you were one of the signers on a letter that went to the president urging him to interpose the necessary objections to the transfer of money from, I assume, your retirement accounts and those of others like you who have served in our government militarily or on the civilian side, that have made possible through underwriting what our capital markets have been doing now for some time. I mean, you're right that the Chinese have been putting immense amounts of resources against these various activities, whether it's space or whether it's the Belt and Road Initiative or military buildup. But it's been our money, substantially, that they've been tapping.
I am so glad you raised that, Frank. So first, let me give you the compliment back again, because you really initiated that letter, and your insights early on in this process were really prescient, and what you just described happened is really a credit both to you and to all those who signed, as well as, frankly, to the president and all those Americans that are watching China. Of course, what happened here is the Thrift Savings Plan, without further limitation, would be able to invest, and we've got other issues to look at this look ahead at that are similar to this, but able to invest in Chinese companies. Can you imagine, and I'll just say again, I represent AMAC. I worked with Reagan White House, Bush 41 White House, worked with Colin Powell, and now I work with a very conservative, very thoughtful group, AMAC.us. That group of 2.1 million Americans have all kinds of investment money, never mind that a lot of them are still working and putting money away. That group of Americans, the last thing in the world they want is to have their money invested in Chinese companies that are then angling either to get at us from space or to get at us with trade or to get at us with security investments, international. Stabilizing international investments in military assets. So the last thing in the world, any of those members, and we just did a big survey, actually, of the AMAC group, and they were overwhelmingly in favor of minimizing the supply chains and dependence on China. The last thing I'll note, which is consistent with this Thrift Savings Plan victory that President Trump, thank God, is putting a stop to the idea that our thrift savings can be invested in Chinese companies, is that China, ironically, unbelievably, claimed to be a needy nation to the World Bank, took out $200 billion of loans at low interest rates, which are available to developed countries, and has turned around and blending them right now at usurious rates to more than 70 countries around the world. It is an outrage. It's something they need to be stopped. The G20 needs to turn on China and say, absolutely not permissible. You need to forestall all interest on those loans, and you need to pay back the loans to the World Bank, because you know who the largest shareholder of the World Bank is? The United States.
Much more to talk about on all of this. Bobby Charles, thank you so much for your time and for your service to our country, which continues these days at AMAC.us. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Fred Flights. We'll take stock with him about what's been going on with this unmasking business and what it might mean for all of us. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by the man who makes this program possible, the president and chief executive officer of the Center for Security Policy, my friend and colleague, Fred Fleitz, a career intelligence professional with experience both as an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency and as a senior executive in the State Department and at the National Security Council, where he served as chief of staff under our friend, the former National Security Advisor, John Bolton, and also as a professional staff member on the House Intelligence Committee. A man who, in short, knows his way around the business of intelligence and the do's and don'ts of it in particular. And it's great to be able to visit with him a bit about some of the breaking news coming out of the intelligence business, specifically related to the unmasking of Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, at the time the National Security Advisor, first National Security Advisor to President Donald Trump. Fred Fleitz, it's good to have you with us as always. Welcome back. Fred, for the people who are either not as conversant as you are with the ways and wiles of the intelligence community, or who have perhaps been out of the loop for the past 48 hours, could you just explain what unmasking is in this context?
It's a great question, Frank, because there's a lot of disinformation by former Obama people about this. Our foreign intelligence agencies are not allowed to collect against Americans except under exceptional circumstances with court authorization. So let's say you were talking to the Chinese ambassador. Your name would be redacted, and did I refer to like person one, a former Reagan administration official, something like that. If someone saw that report, let's say it was an NSA report, intercepted communications, wanted to know who person was, what the identity person one, they have to have a very good reason. They have to be fairly senior. It's submitted to the NSA, and it goes through a special process, and the name is orally relayed to the requester, and that person's told they cannot reveal it. So it's an exceptional process. Now, I was a CIA analyst for 19 years. I didn't even know you could do this for my first 15 years at CIA. I handled 10 of these requests for John Bolton. He was undersecretary. He made 10 requests in 4 years at State. Now, Deputy Secretary Armitage, we learned, made about 100. But Obama's ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, made 260 requests. And I think she made 7 between Election Day and Inauguration Day just of General Flynn's name. And it raises all kinds of questions because I don't think she made those requests herself. I think they were made in her name, but someone else, they were made on behalf of someone else.
So, Fred, again, this is a bit of inside baseball, I guess, but I think all of us have a keen interest to understand how this works. You're saying there are exceptional circumstances. You're saying that only certain people have the knowledge of this capability, let alone the authority to use it. And when they do, they're supposed to provide good reasons for doing it. And who evaluates those requests and who approves them ultimately? And how many people do you think actually have this kind of latitude for what it certainly seems is a potentially very devastating instrument of political warfare?
It really is, because think about it. This is a way to obtain information on someone's communications without a warrant. This is a way to spy on an American without a warrant. And that's what happened to General Flynn. I'd say like maybe the top two or three tiers of agencies like State and the Defense Department are request this. Of the 39 people named in the list of demaskers yesterday, of people who asked for Flynn's name, most of them were intelligence officers and military officers. They probably were not asking for this information for any political reasons. And also a lot of them were Obama political appointees who were soon leaving office. And I might add, this included Joe Biden, who asked on January 12th for Flynn's name in an intelligence report.
Yeah, and he doesn't remember doing that, evidently, but as has been pointed out by others, he seemingly doesn't remember a lot of things these days, so that may or may not be dispositive. But Fred, when that information is released, and again, who is it that evaluates these requests? You mentioned the National Security Agency. Is there a high-level review that takes place, and is it possible to see, as a result of this kind of, you know, disclosure by Rick Grinnell, the current Director of National Intelligence, acting Director of National Intelligence, we're getting some insights into some of this, but we haven't seen the requests themselves that supposedly justify these unmaskings. Who would have evaluated them, and might we see those in the future, do you think?
Well, NSA says there are about 20 officials who have the authorization to make these, to provide these names. And I think there's probably several officials who have to sign off. And it didn't used to be this way, but at least starting with the George W. Bush administration, the requesting official had to sign a form, give the reason when he made this request. I hope that that process continued through the Obama years. I don't know. I don't know what the process was. I know that after it became known over the last few years of this huge number of demasks made by Obama officials, the Trump administration significantly changed the rules to make it harder to make these requests and to have the paperwork, much, much more extensive paperwork on it.
But they also, as I understand it, during the Obama years, greatly increased the number of people who could make these requests. Is that correct?
I don't know that that's true. I do know toward the end of the administration, Barack Obama made a decision that greatly increased the number of officials who had access to sensitive intelligence. I don't know whether that included the ability to make demasking requests. I think that's something we need to find out.
Yeah. Well, it may be that I'm mistaken in terms of the question of asking for the demasking, but getting access to the unmasked information, I think, is what was greatly expanded. And I don't need to tell you, but there's a sort of working hypothesis on the part of most of us who've had time in the government that the practical effect of that was essentially to assure that somebody would leak it perhaps with malign intent aimed at the individual whose identity was being disclosed. Your thoughts?
Well, the director of NSA testified about 2 years ago, this is Admiral Mike Rogers, that the name is provided orally only to the requester, and the requester is told this is very sensitive and they're not allowed to share it. So the chief of staff of a master power should not have been allowed to ask for this information and certainly share it with others. But if these requests were being made in power's name and she wasn't aware of it, obviously that rule wasn't being followed.
Very troubling, Fred. And just, I guess, if you could give us your sense at the moment of what this means for General Flynn getting some measure of justice at the end of this horrific process.
It's really stunning information. It's more evidence that intelligence was weaponized to destroy the president and destroy Flynn as part of the effort to destroy the president. Our intelligence agencies were being used by an outgoing administration to spy on the personnel of the incoming administration to destroy it. And you know that we have a principle in this country called the peaceful transfer of power. The outgoing administration is supposed to fully cooperate with the incoming administration, not spy on them, and to task political appointees who will stay behind to use intelligence that wasn't disclosed to the incoming administration to spy on them and to destroy them.
Yeah, it's scandalous in the extreme and cries out for prosecution, it seems to me. Fred Fleitz, let me just ask you in closing, as we're speaking, news has broken that Richard Burr, the senator from North Carolina who has been the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has just stepped down from that post, not from his Senate seat, but from that particular post, presumably as a result of the difficulties he's having at the moment over some stock transactions that have raised ethical issues. What can you tell us about Richard Burr's tenure as the chairman of that committee, and who might be coming next?
Well, I've been very disappointed in Senator Burr. I think he's been quite a weak chairman of Senate Intelligence. Many people have been saying that he's basically let the vice chairman, Mark Warner, the Democrat from Virginia, run the committee. I don't think he's been aggressive at all in focusing on how this Russia collusion matter was a hoax. And he put out a report recently that validated a terrible intelligence assessment of Russian meddling in the 2016 election that, you know, basically read like it was talking points by the Obama administration. So not sorry to see him leaving that committee. I'm not sure who the new chairman will be, but it can only be an improvement over Burr.
Well, we will be watching that closely. I believe James Risch of Idaho is next in line, but he's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. It'll be interesting to see whether he'll leave that vaunted position in favor of this, or whether perhaps Marco Rubio, who I believe is next in line after him, might take it over, which would be quite an interesting development, given Senator Rubio's quite robust positions on communist China, most especially. We'll be, as I say, attending to this, as will you, Fred Pleitz. Thank you for your leadership at the Center for Security Policy and your visits with us each week. We look forward to doing it next week. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Next up, we will speak, as mentioned, with Sam Faddis, another former CIA hand on the operations side, about this intelligence business, masking and unmasking and the like, and much more. Straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I am thrilled to say we are joined by Sam Faddis. He is a career intelligence professional, but has served his country in a variety of other capacities as well, including in the United States Army as a judge advocate, as well as a captain who I believe was in tanks for a time. He is also a former assistant attorney general in Washington State and a former congressional candidate. A man of many parts, the author of numerous books, and now the driving force behind a terrific online resource and magazine. Sam Faddis, it's good to have you back. Welcome. So much to talk about, Sam. Let me jump right into where I left off with Fred Pleitz. Your thoughts on what has become now apparently a political warfare device for the Obama team, namely the unmasking of American citizens. We know now a good bit about what was done to Michael Flynn, about whom we'll speak more in a moment. But just generally, Sam, as an intelligence professional, what do you make of this practice?
Well, I mean, everybody should understand that, first of all, in the intelligence community, it is generally the practice to stay about 10 miles away from American citizens. It's not our job to spy on them. We don't try to spy on them. Most of the time, if you stumble across one in the midst of something else that's not directed at them, you do your best just not to focus on them at all and not to pick up their names and put it into traffic, et cetera. So there's nothing routine about what's going on with this unmasking. This whole thing about identifying Flynn and connecting him to which is what the unmasking is all about, connecting him to whoever he's talking to. This is spying, deliberate spying on a guy who was a principal advisor to the Republican candidate for office and then the national security advisor. This is the intelligence community spying on the new president's national security advisor. Straight up, there's no other way to characterize it.
And in terms of an abuse of the instruments of intelligence collection, I assume you would find that offensive. And as a guy who used to protect citizens' rights as the assistant attorney general in Washington State, I assume this is doubly offensive, is it not?
Yeah, it's horribly offensive, frankly. I don't think there's any way that you're going to be able to characterize this ultimately as anything other than criminal. I mean, what you have here, if you look at those documents that have just come out, and you look at the scope of the number of unmasking requests and the number of individuals focused on this, this is a very large number of individuals who are deliberately monitoring the communications of General Flynn, who is, as I say, the principal advisor to the guy who might be next president of the United States, and then becomes the national security advisor for the next president of the United States. And our intelligence apparatus, which shouldn't be focused on him at all, is clearly obsessed with his communications and his contacts. And of course, once you've identified that and established that he's in contact with these people, that you don't magically then forget that. I mean, what you're doing now is mapping all of his contact, all of his activities. An apparatus that's supposed to be looking at our enemies directed inward at our own officials. This is the ultimate abuse.
And to make matters worse, we now know that Barack Obama personally expanded the universe of people who would have the opportunity to abuse such powers. As my recollection is, it was something like 3,000 individuals. Sam, that is a formula, premeditated formula, it would seem, for leaking as well as abuse of these powers. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've seen so far, and this is just based on relative handfuls of documents that have been declassified, is what is crystal clear is what those of us who were really watching it carefully have known for a long time. This conspiracy, and that's what it was, still is not a handful of guys at the FBI, and it's not just people being over exuberant. This is a massive conspiracy. And I think as you see more documents come out, you're going to realize this is going to wash all the way up into the White House itself. I mean, a lot of people that have been trying to stand clear of this who are going to be directly implicated.
I think that's unquestionably the case. And I hope that this is a focus of effort for John Durham right now. We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you, Sam Faddis. Let me turn to two other things very much related to the first. You've written recently, an excoriating article, I think it's fair to say, about this Judge Emmett Sullivan and the role that he is currently playing to, continue the persecution. And I didn't say prosecution, I said persecution of General Michael Flynn.
Yeah, well, completely indefensible. This guy ought to be thrown off the bench. I don't understand at all. In the American system of jurisprudence, the state brings charges, the prosecutor at state level, federal level, whatever. And then there's defense counsel, and the judge makes sure everything goes according to the rules. The prosecution has walked away. They have formally admitted misconduct and said, we're not prosecuting the general anymore. And yet somehow this judge is continuing a prosecution in a federal court in the absence of a prosecutor. I'm sorry, that's not our system of justice. You don't get to just decide to invite other people in and argue if they think the general should be prosecuted. The prosecutors have walked away. There's no case. We've never seen anything like this in American jurisprudence. It's insane.
Is there anything that can be done about this judge simply going rogue?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Department of Justice could formally jump in and make exactly the case that I just made. I think also the Department of Justice could jump in and elevate this thing right now before we wait any more time directly to the Supreme Court. Interestingly, only days ago, the Supreme Court issued a ruling about a similar thing that happened in the Ninth Circuit, where they just sort of went rogue and invited people in. And Justice Ginsburg, of all people, wrote the majority opinion in which she beat up on the Ninth Circuit and said straight up, this is not our system of justice. You can't do this. And almost the next day, this district court judge does the same thing.
So there is something of a precedent to what he did. It's just that the Supremes have already weighed in. Was it a unanimous ruling?
I don't remember. I mean, it was obviously at least a majority opinion. She wrote for the majority, and she said, look, and this is the Ninth Circuit, which is sort of her darling. I mean, if you want to talk about politics, and she pulled no punches. She said, basically, this is not our system of justice. I have no idea what you did out there, but don't ever do it again.
then this should be short work, hopefully, and will allow justice, finally, a measure of it at least, to be served to an honorable and patriotic American, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. The military, of course, is something you know a good bit about, Sam, as a result of your own service, as well as having worked with it when you were in deep cover in the Central Intelligence Agency. Talk a little bit about this announced decision of the Defense Department to buy some 500 million injectors for vaccines that apparently are designed to have in them these nano chips that will enable the tracking of the individuals who have received the vaccine. What are the implications for all of that, for our military first and foremost, but for our society more generally, Sam?
Yeah, I think all of this is terrifying, Frank. I mean, I'm not belittling the necessity, especially early on, to respond to this threat from the virus, particularly the point where we didn't know what it was going to do domestically. But to now use this as an excuse to sort of just trash all civil liberties and just sort of any action can be justified on the grounds that, well, we got to do this to fight the virus, it literally terrifies me. I mean, down this road is mass tracking of people and everybody being registered and sort of the end of all personal liberty. And I'm sure the military is being reluctantly shoved into this, the average guy or gal that want to go down this road. But I think we really need to be very cautious about all of this, not just this, but anything else like it. This whole thing where we're soon going to turn around and find out you're registered, tracked, monitored for every aspect of your life. Kind of reminds you of the Communist Chinese Party.
Well, it does indeed. In fact, I'm fond of saying on this program and elsewhere, Sam Faddis, that the Chinese have held forth ever since they unleashed this disease on us. That the way I put it is, communism is a cure for coronavirus, and this really seems to be of a piece of it. And the fact that this vaccine business is being brought to us by the likes of Bill Gates and Dr. Tony Fauci seems is all the more reason for concern about its potential for, as you say, controlling people. Right now, Chinese people, under their social credit system, are being tracked relentlessly. They are being denied on the basis of whether they have, the appropriate credentials health-wise to get to work, get food, get out of their apartments, for heaven's sakes. I mean, this is where things inexorably lead, it would seem, and it is indeed frightening, as you say.
Yeah, well, it's terrifying, and many of the people that you mentioned, I mean, don't seem to find any problem with the Chinese system. They, like you and I look at it, and most Americans look at it and think, oh my God, that's this dystopian nightmare. And yet these guys look seriously, like Gates seem to think, hey, we should be more like them. That's the future. That's where we should go.
Including, as it turns out, his enthusiasm for population control of the kind that the Chinese have been doing to the extraordinary detriment of their people and country as it happens. Sam Faddis, so much more to talk about, but that's it for today. Thank you very much for your time, as always, and for your extraordinary service to our country, Sam, and that you are continuing to render these days, among other places, at andmagazine.com. Check it out, folks. Thanks, Sam. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we will speak with David Goldman. We'll explore with him some of the things that the president has been doing lately to try to prevent our underwriting of that Chinese Communist Party. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are visiting in this segment with a good friend and very valued contributor to this program, David Goldman. He is a man of many parts, among other things, as I recall, an aficionado of music, as well as history, the author of innumerable, incredibly interesting, thoughtful, and important columns at Asia Times, and also of the book How Civilizations Die. He has a new book coming out shortly, You Will Be Assimilated, about, topic A on this program most days, Communist China and its plans for the rest of us. David Goldman, it's good to have you with us. Welcome, sir. Well, David, I wanted to get your thoughts. I think, are on different sides of this topic, but your thoughts on the decision that the president made earlier this week to preclude the thrift savings plan from investing a relatively small amount of money, but I think the symbolic implications of this are substantially larger in Chinese Communist companies on our stock market, including a number that are sanctioned by the United States government, that are involved in oppressing the people of China, that are involved in building weapon systems with which to attack us. This would seem to me to be a sensible and indeed quite laudable step. Your thoughts?
The thing that worries me about Chinese companies is they're also building our weapon systems. We're dependent on Chinese components for plasma screens at the Pentagon and chips in nuclear submarines.
And I think President Trump spoke about that earlier today with Maria Bartiromo, as a matter of fact.
Yes. The administration is talking about self-sufficiency in computer chips. They so far have not gotten a lot of cooperation from the best fabrication company in the world, Taiwan Semiconductor, which is very reluctant to build plants in the United States for its own reasons. Doing this is going to be a really hard and expensive thing to do. My guess is the bill is going to be in the range of $100 billion. But it's the kind of thing we have to do, because otherwise the Chinese can plant little time bombs in computer chips, which are undetectable by any method that anybody has. That's how sophisticated the technology is. So we need to do it. Compared to this kind of existential threat to us, I find it difficult to get worked up about symbolic actions, which really don't do much to the Chinese. I mean, if we don't invest $4 billion or so in federal pension money into the Chinese, which is what the allocation would be to the Chinese market, that's 0.1% of the market capitalization of the Shanghai Composite. Chinese companies, for the most part, almost entirely, are not dependent on the U.S. market. So it doesn't really do much in terms of the real underlying power balance, which is my concern.
I guess the point here is that I think this is the leading edge, especially when you look at the language that Larry Kudlow and Robert O'Brien, the National Economic Council Director and National Security Advisor to the President, respectively, used in a letter to the Labor Secretary, Gene Scalia, that made clear that this is a bigger problem than just this thrift savings plan. The material risk undisclosed in these various Chinese companies, the threats to national security and humanitarian values, is certainly true of companies that are being invested in by an awful lot of other Americans. And so the question really comes down to this, it seems to me, is will we have the Securities and Exchange Commission and maybe the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board finally applying to Chinese companies in our capital markets the same rules that apply to American registrants and others? And that would be, I think, more than symbolic. It may not be completely decisive, we'll see, but I think it could be an important step in the right direction. Let me ask you, David, about Hong Kong. You've spent time there. You cover what happens there closely at Asia Times, of course. There does seem to be, in the wake of the pandemic, now an intensifying crackdown on the people of Hong Kong. And this augurs ill, it seems, for freedom there, what's left of it, and perhaps a precursor to the kinds of things that they seem to have in mind for Taiwan as well. Your thoughts?
Well, the Chinese are demonstrably acting in an extremely aggressive way towards Hong Kong, introducing a number of pieces of legislation that people don't like, including a symbolic national anthem bill, which is something of a provocation. They're trying to show how tough they are. This is Xi Jinping saying, we're not going to tolerate any deviation from the party line in the context of the coronavirus crisis. And there have been revived demonstrations, though nothing of the scale we saw last year. It's hard to know where this thing will lead, but clearly the Chinese Communist Party is trying to show its iron fist and intimidate people. I don't believe that this is likely to spill over into the mainland directly, simply because Hong Kong really is a British city. That happens to have a Chinese population. It's never had much relation to the mainland. But it does reflect the fact that Xi Jinping is extremely unpopular after the coronavirus crisis. The brutality with which they ran the lockdown and the fact that they covered up the situation for at least a number of weeks, which led to a lot of unnecessary deaths in China and elsewhere, has led to enormous and justified criticism of the regime. And instead of reforming, admitting error, and trying to repair the thing, they've simply hunkered down and tried to show how tough they are. So that's not a good situation.
Not a good situation, and it's, I'm afraid, likely to get worse, isn't it, before it's over. Your thoughts on Taiwan? Is there intensifying danger that the Chinese might actually engage in kinetic activities against the Taiwanese?
Well, look, the United States is clearly concerned about the military balance in the South China Sea. We removed our bombers from Guam, which is a critical signal because the Chinese have long-range missiles that can wipe Guam out and destroy our bases. So pulling our bombers back out of the range of Chinese missiles is a preparatory step against an eventual conflict. It doesn't mean that one is imminent or that the United States or the Chinese want a military conflict. But the other thing, which the Chinese have to be concerned about, is the Japanese have vastly increased their military budget. They're building up their naval and air capabilities. And if, God forbid, we have a military conflict, the Chinese would be probably more afraid of what the Japanese might do as an American ally than American forces in the region per se. So clearly there has been a significant increase in military tensions and significant preparations on both sides for a possible conflict, which thankfully is still very possible and hopefully avoidable.
Do you worry, knowing the Chinese as you do, David Goldman, that the removal of the bombers from Guam, these B-52s that we've stationed there for some time, might actually encourage them to believe that they could engage in hostilities that we're signaling we're unprepared to counter?
B-52s can fly from anywhere. I don't think that's the Chinese concern, and they're much less afraid of the B-52s than, say, the F-35s, which both we and the Japanese are flying. They have the Russian S-400 air defense system, which is formidable, but the F-35 very well might be able to defeat it. A combination of F-18 Hornets with a so-called Growler jamming aircraft also might be able to defeat the S-400. So I think the United States' withdrawal of B-52s is not a display of weakness, but an indication that, you know, we're ready to scrap if we have to. The dispersion of Marine forces around the Pacific, the smaller bases, in other words, less susceptible to Chinese missile bombardment, would be a parallel thing. And from a military standpoint, it has a very clear logic. The problem is the Chinese have a formidable missile force. The University of Sydney in Australia last year published a study saying that within hours, Chinese missiles could wipe out most American assets in the Western Pacific. So there are ways to counter that, but one is not to leave assets in place as a sitting duck for Chinese missiles.
Very quickly, there's a rule that's being proposed by the Commerce Department to have American companies participate in standard-setting meetings with Huawei for the fifth generation wireless. Your book is focused on that topic. Your thoughts, David? Advisable or not?
Well, there's no way to prevent American companies from talking to Huawei about standards. If, for example, we're going to be seling equipment around the world, or software or whatever, we have to know what the Huawei standards are. So that by itself is not a significant concession. It's simply a recognition that Huawei is going to be a major player in that market, and it's not within our power to wave a magic wand and make it go away.
We will be watching it closely, as will you, I know. David Goldman, thank you for your time today, as well as for your insights into so many of these topics, which you provide us week upon week. Look forward to doing so again next week. Look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.